You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Yeah, come on in and join the party. It's like I told you a little earlier. Our special guest in this segment, the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management segment, is a marine biologist who's going to talk with us about some of the things, dispel some of the rumors about where we are, and are we overfished? Are we taking too much? Are we sustainable? What's the science like? This guy has written a number of papers. He focuses on conservation and natural resource management, which is what we've been trying to do here for centuries in Hawaii and in the Pacific, and probably doing a pretty good job. We'll ask him about that. He is Dr. Ray Hilborn, like I said, a marine biologist and fishery scientist. And we have so much to begin with, I don't even know where to start. First of all, welcome to Hawaii. Is this your first time here, or you've been here before?
Oh, I've been here quite a few times.
Yeah, of course before. I know, because you got a nice Aloha shirt on.
It wasn't just it's from last year.
Yeah. What was when did you first get interested in marine biology? At what age, do you think?
Oh, in marine biology?
Yeah.
I mean, I was a great keeper of tropical fish when I was in high school, okay. But then I went in and did my PhD studying rodents. Mm. And I really didn't get into fisheries until I started looking for a job after I got my PhD.
Isn't that funny? A lot of times you go to college, they say, that's going to be great. You're going to get that degree, then what are you going to do?
No. Yeah. Well, I was lucky. I graduated about the time the U.S. was declaring 200-mile zones.
Mm-hmm.
And not the U.S., and lots of countries. And most of the people I studied with in graduate school went into fisheries, whether they worked on insects or birds.
Sure.
There was just enormous amount of hiring going on, and particularly in governments.
How fortuitous was it for that to be done? I mean, you know, it was, I guess, maybe like the Wild West before these lines of demarcation were drawn. I mean, there was very little, you know, reason to even have science. I mean, was there a base?
Well, it's probably the most important thing that happened in fisheries management is, the lesson we have is you can't let everybody who wants to take the fish take the fish.
It's interesting here, though, and I'm sure you've seen this. Mm-hmm. Here in Hawaii, we kind of don't like being told that, you know, and we're kind of like the outlaws. We're the only state in the union, as a matter of fact, that doesn't have some sort of licensing needed for recreational fishery. And I don't know if we need it or not, but what we do need to know is what science is good and what science is bad. So hopefully we can get at some of that.
Well, I'm happy to, but I guarantee you, your Hawaiians don't want foreigners coming in and catching your fish here.
So,
everybody says, oh no, we don't want to exclude anyone, but we've already made the big exclusion by saying, you know, only people who live here can go fishing.
One of the rumors that we need to dispel, I hope we can, is that there is a lot of these stock assessments and things that are done now are a little bit more accurate than they used to be. And I know that optimally there must be a better way to do it, but as we're doing it right now, doesn't it sort of give a checks and balances as to what some of the environmentalists might say, we can't do this anymore, and science would say, well, that's not exactly true, we can do this some more.
Well, you want all your fisheries decisions to be consistent with good science. I mean, science can't tell you exactly how to manage the fisheries because there's lots of social questions and economic questions, but they need to be consistent with good science, and we need to understand what the status of the resources are in order to know what kind of management system to put in place.
What do we need to know about overfishing? We hear that word and everybody panics. Oh my goodness, Waikiki, we close it for a year and the stock comes back and then we open it and on the first day of the year, the fish is all gone. So, I mean, is overfishing real?
Oh, certainly overfishing is real. Mm-hmm. And when we look around the world, what you discover is that the story depends on where you are.
Mm-hmm.
And some places have lots of overfishing. Other places, most of the United States' large commercial fisheries, overfishing's completely stopped.
Mm-hmm.
But, the mid-1990s, when the concern about overfishing really started to build, it was the norm in much of the world. Not everywhere, but in fact, the Pacific has been because fisheries developed later here, in general, certainly in the U.S., Pacific, Australia, and New Zealand, overfishing hasn't been nearly as common as it has, say, in the North Atlantic.
Mm-hmm. On that point, you know, listeners of this show are big fans of Wicked Tuna and North and South and all that stuff. And even last week, I had one of the skippers on talking about that. And they're pretty regulated. But we know here, particularly our longline fishery, we are amongst the heaviest regulated fisheries there are. We thought, well, look, all that, you know, eastern seaboard stuff, all that overfishing made all those boats come to the Pacific. And so we got a lot more boats than there used to be. Let's talk about how this actual thing, what we need to know, you know, what you're concentrating on letting us know about this overfishing, this whole concept of overfishing.
Well, I think first we need to say, what do we mean by overfishing?
Yeah.
And there are several kinds of overfishing. The traditional definition has to do with sustainable yield, how many pounds of fish you can continue to take. And what overfishing technically means is that that you are achieving in the long term less potential yield than you could have because you're fishing too hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, overfishing does not equate to collapse or to extinction. It simply means you could produce more if you didn't fish as hard.
It's very interesting because I know that's counterintuitive to some people, but we've seen, it's not anecdotal. You can go to certain nearshore fisheries and see devastation, see where somebody's come in and maybe netted every juvenile out of the water, so that place is overfished. Doesn't mean it can't be restocked, but there's no fish there now. What about offshore? Same thing?
Certainly. I mean, there's just lots of examples of where fishing pressure was so high that we really reduced populations enormously, and the amount of catch that could be taken was very low, and you need to basically let those stocks recover. Now, again, the North Atlantic is sort of the home of industrial overfishing, and in general, the stocks there are recovering pretty nicely, mm-hmm. but we've had to reduce catch and fleet sizes, in many cases a lot, in order to let that recovery happen.
In some areas, I imagine, if people just shrug their shoulders and say, well, I can't buy that tuna anymore, I'll eat Vienna sausages. But what about the people that where the demand outstrips the sanity? In other words, they're just going to say, oh, yeah, that's nice, but we got to go fishing.
Well, that's true in lots of places. And there is, it's not an oxymoron to talk about sustainable overfishing. That is, you can have depleted the resources, but continue to take a sustainable yield, and it would be called overfished, so long as that was less than you could do if you had more fish in the water.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, I think lots of the world is in that position, particularly the developing world that doesn't have a fisheries management system, doesn't have a legal framework. So we think that a very high portion of the fish stocks in Southeast Asia are overfished, but they're still producing a lot of food, mm-hmm. but they could probably produce more if they didn't fish as hard.
Okay, now let's explain that a little bit. When you say fish hard, we have got, as the demand has grown, so has the techniques improved. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are much more efficient. We can catch more fish. We can go out and find them a lot easier with the electronics. But when you say that fishing hard as compared to overfishing, what does that mean?
Well, in terms of overfishing, it means you're taking too big a fraction of the fish that are there. Now, mm-hmm. whether you're doing that with two large boats or 100 small boats, mm-hmm. you know, a dead fish is a dead fish.
Right.
It doesn't really care how many boats it took to catch it.
Mm-hmm.
So we always talk in the science world in what fraction of the population you take. And so in most populations can sustain anywhere from a 5 to 30 or 40% fraction annual take.
Mm-hmm.
But many European fisheries say we're taking 60 or 70% every year,
mm-hmm.
and probably sustainably doing so, but not getting nearly as much as they could have if they were taking 20%.
Yeah, that's really an interesting thing. And I know probably hard to wrap their people. Some people have their trouble wrapping their minds around that. What I think is interesting for our fishery, and maybe you can comment to the fact that we have a commercial fishery, which is pretty easy to measure what they're catching, particularly in our longline fleet. Mm-hmm. It all comes through the auction.
Yeah.
We kind of know what's being caught. But here we have this great unwashed part of the population that's maybe weekend warrior, semi-commercial, maybe recreational, but even the recreational guy is feeding an extended family. So how important is it for some of these factions to understand, look, nobody's going to immediately hurt us, but we need to fess up so that the scientists can make sense of what we're doing here. Does that help?
Yeah, well, that recreational fisheries are particularly difficult because you have so many people. It's very difficult to collect data on how many fish are being caught and the size and distribution. Here, you're also just dealing with so many species.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like the salmon fishery where you're dealing with a handful of species. You're dealing with dozens and dozens of species. You know, you can manage these fisheries with very little data, but what that would mean is that you've got a good chance of not doing as well as if you had better data.
We always get stuck on the data portion here, and I know that as a scientist, you can reach out to the most skeptical of listeners and say, hey, look, do your part to be a part of it. You know, at what goes on at the council, at wpcouncil.org, we know we have these great inner meetings. There's meetings going on throughout the Pacific this in just a matter of a little bit. But here in Hawaii, we kind of think that we're the nucleus of the world, right? We're the center of the hub. And yet we're such a small part of the fishery to deal with, but it's not small to us. Let's talk about the information that you need. You've written a number of papers, and you continue to do so based on the science of stock assessments. And how are we getting to a point where it's valuable, reliable, definable information? Or is it?
Well, you know? I am not an expert on local Hawaiian fisheries. Mm-hmm. I do know a fair amount about the big industrial fisheries, the long swordfish and tuna, tuna fisheries. But what you really want to understand is how many fish are being caught. But even more important than that is simply the size and what kind of fish are being caught. Because when you get into overfishing, what usual results is you end up with quite small fish, and the longer lived species start to disappear. So you could, I don't even know how Hawaiian sport fisheries are managed. I'm assuming probably just seasons and bag limits. That's pretty well the norm. But you could manage those fisheries just based on the size and the species composition, and never actually know the catch.
Sure. They're looking at quantifying some species and labeling them and not. We don't have any real bag limits or size limits in the pelagic fish. You know, I mean, they're looking at swordfish. They're certainly looking at striped marlin. They're looking at some other things, but it's hard to put a handle on it. And that's because a lot of the fishermen, and I used to be included in that group, are not forthcoming with information. They think, well, if I tell them I'm catching 8 ahi, they're going to not let me catch 6. Uh-huh. But if you don't tell them you're catching 8, they're not going to let you catch any. So where is the happy medium? What should people fess up to?
Well, I think it's in the interest of everybody to know as much about the fishery as possible. And there's a lot of really interesting work going on now in developing apps for cell phones.
Yeah, no kidding.
That you could basically report your information that way. Mm-hmm. It just really isn't in anyone's interest to not know about the status of the fishery, because if you don't know what's going on, there's a good chance it'll be closed or reduced unnecessarily, or it wouldn't be reduced when, some catch measure might not be implemented that actually would result in a benefit by getting better management.
You know, there is more than anecdotal facts to support. As we go here in Hawaii, we're reconstructing the old fish ponds and some of these things, and it turns out that looking back historically, the Hawaiian people had a pretty good handle on overfishing and seasons and bag limits and things, because they didn't just say, well, mullet season is June. They said, well, mullet season is June over here, but over in that part of the state is July. So we had this great intercommunicative system going, which we don't seem to have anymore. Is that something that needs to be revived? I mean, get, you know, local area-based consulting in when we make these decisions about size, bag, and season?
Oh, definitely. That one of the lessons we've learned from fisheries around the world is trying to regionalize at the smallest possible scale that it's practical, the management of the fisheries, because every place is different. And if you look at how native communities throughout the Pacific managed their fisheries before European contact, they had developed a whole host of ways of sustaining their fisheries. And
it was vital, wasn't it?
That's what they lived on.
Exactly.
And when the Europeans came in, They impose sort of a top-down, we'll have a state or a national government fisheries agency, and the traditional methods of management largely evaporated. And certainly in many of the Western Pacific countries where I used to work when I worked for the South Pacific Commission, they're reasserting these community-based management systems.
Were they more receptive to listen to science? I mean, you've had this experience in that part of the world where, I don't want to say maybe they knew it all already. They didn't need us to come in and tell them about their fishery. But maybe they've cottoned to, wait a minute. These guys came in, they took an objective look at what we're doing and came up with the following guidelines.
Well, I don't think you want the scientists to come in with the guidelines. Mm-hmm. You want them to come in and say, well, if you do this, this will happen. But you know, the choice of how you manage the fishery, this is really social, economic, political. It's not science. And all science can do is say, well, if you do that, you're going to have this problem. If you do that, mm-hmm. it'll work out well or whatever. But, you know, the solution and the way you manage the fishery really depends upon the nature of the existing community and what they want out of the fishery.
Last year at one of the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council get-togethers with fishermen, I was talking to this guy that said, you know, here's the problem. Let's say that you have a bottom fish limit or ground fish limit, which we do in pounds, you know, mm-hmm. and we've reached the limit, so no more. But the demand by the consumer is still there. So now he demands, okay, bring it from somewhere else. If we can't catch it locally, let's get it from somewhere else. Now we go somewhere else that might have been managing their fishery pretty well, and all of a sudden they have an opportunity to sell thousands of pounds or tons of their fish. Does that put, that must put a load on bordering and neighboring fisheries as well?
Oh, that's a, you know, I mean, the U.S. nationally, we import over 80% of our fish.
It comes from somewhere.
And it comes from somewhere. And some of those places are well managed, and some of them aren't. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the issues that, you know, the U.S. nationally has become more and more restrictive and very, very conservative, that we're probably taking not much more than 2/3 of what we could take mm-hmm. nationally. And it's sort of on this, I have to sometimes call it an illusion, that it's good for the environment to protect our fish. But it's not if we make up that by importing those fish from some place that doesn't have a good management system, or even worse, replacing the fish we would eat with beef that's produced somewhere
sure.
else.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that comes up every now and again here, Ray, and that is that, you know, we go about this where we want a certain species. And you go out and look for them, and they're not there. Well, you just take something else. Mm-hmm. And there are some that, and so we do that. And if there's none of that, then we can go to a can of something. But aren't there places where if something happens to their fishery, it's life-threatening to the whole society. Because if those fish aren't there, they don't eat. There's just no food supply.
Yeah, that a very high portion of the world's fish catch is consumed by poor people. Mm-hmm. who are nutritionally very dependent upon those. And so, yeah. you know, I mean, we have options, right? I mean, we can import fish, but, you know, there are
We can almost clone them. That's
We can farm them. You know, I mean, there's a lot, and we can buy livestock. Mm-hmm. But the poor people of the world who really depend upon fisheries, both for incomes and nutrition, don't have those options.
I just came up with something just out of my own curiosity. I'm sure others think about it too, is that we know that there are certain specialists. Let's say that somebody's after ahi or big eye, and that's what they long line for. That's what they fish for. Aren't there parts of the place where there is no such thing as bycatch? Or they won't keep the bycatch. They want a certain species. If they don't get that, it just goes to waste. That doesn't seem to be happening here. Somebody's trying to catch a mai mai and they catch an ono, they'll eat the ono and they'll be happy about it. But is that a problem? Are we tossing a lot of the food supply because the fisher didn't want that species?
Again, it all depends on where. Mm-hmm. You know, that the places that are unregulated, actually they tend to keep everything these days because mm-hmm. there's such a demand for fish meal for aquaculture. But there are other places where, as you say, there are specialists and they will just catch what they want and then discard the rest. Mm-hmm. It just depends on where.
I'm thinking that maybe commercial fishermen will accept science. They'll accept somebody coming in, especially if they're being paid to produce a study, not necessarily to tell me what I want to hear, but to give me a real gut check so that I know, for instance, how many permits to release in the commercial area. Mm-hmm. But what about in the domestic, you know, the guys that say, like you said, we tell other countries, don't come in here anymore within this limit. What about guys that say, don't come to our beach? Your beach is right down the road. Don't come to our beach because our beach can't sustain your demand.
Well, that's basically a complicated issue. And
but see, you mentioned that part of what you do is not just the science of the number of fish, but it's the social implications.
Yeah, and that's that issue has, U.S. law doesn't let us discriminate. Mm-hmm. So the Alaskans have the biggest fishery in the United States,
right?
And they would love to keep people from Seattle from coming to fish there, mm-hmm. but they can't do it under U.S. law.
You say that it's very interesting because we have a pretty well beaten path from here to Alaska. Our guys love going up to those rivers and using the eggs and catching the salmon, and it's such an experience. But sometimes they're not welcome too. I mean, some of those lodges they have people picking them sometimes. They keep our fish.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, no, okay. But one of the issues. I mean, I spend summers in Alaska working on salmon.
Sure.
And the problem is that the fishing permits in the commercial fisheries have been drifting out of Alaska down to the lower 48 because there's so many more people in the lower 48, a lot of professional fishermen who have good access to banks. And for small communities in Alaska, this is a big deal. They're losing their fishing permits.
You know, and we could probably go into a whole nother mindset on that, and time permitting, we certainly could. There's a lot more than just that limit. There's pretty good science that suggests if you don't stop at a certain point, these fish that are trying to go upstream won't get there. And if they don't get there, nothing's going to happen coming downstream. Is that pretty well documented to the point where now some of these closures and limits make a lot of sense?
In Alaska?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Alaska salmon fisheries are generally extremely well-regulated. They're the sort of often the model for really good management. Where I work in Bristol Bay, we have this great system where we actually can count the fish as they swim up the stream.
Amazing, huh? Yeah.
Because they swim right along the sides of the rivers.
Yeah.
There's basically towers that are built along the side of the rivers, and the guy's sitting there with a clicker counting the fish up, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
It's kind of like right now some people that are listening to the program are also part of the Great Aloha Run that's happening on President's Day, and they're looking at, there's the monitor in your shoe as you pass the line of counts. And that's great, these going upstream. I'll tell you what people had a rough time with. We were in a group, we went up the Susitna River in Anchorage, and up at the top of the river where the spawning is going on, people just couldn't believe that these fish lay their eggs and then they just die along the side of the river, and we got to go get those. We got to put them in the coolers. That's all part of a big, it's part of a big system to understand, isn't it?
But I guarantee you, they probably wouldn't like those fish that have spawned. Their fat's way gone. Yeah, they're not very tasty.
It is amazing how they physically change their appearance as they're heading up there. In other words, they must know I'm going to do my thing and then I'm dead.
Oh yeah, they got millions of years of evolution taught them.
Yeah. What do you think? And unfortunately, I'm not sure that we really understand. Sometimes it takes science a while to catch up with the need. How precarious are we, in your opinion, here in the Pacific? How many cliffs or how many fires does science need to help us put out with regards to catch, limits, and maybe even bad science that's out there making our esteemed leaders make inaccurate decisions about things?
Well, again, the answer is almost certainly it depends on where. Mm-hmm. But the Pacific is, of all the places in the world, is probably the one I have the least concern about.
Okay, that's good news.
The big industrial fisheries of the U.S. Pacific, of the high seas tuna fisheries, are still in good shape. The Western Pacific, the Tuna Commission that does the Western Pacific, doesn't have it hasn't really been challenged yet, and I know there's lots of pressure to get them to start regulating those fisheries more effectively, but they've got the big yellowfin skipjack resources haven't gotten in trouble yet.
Yeah, interesting. And here in Hawaii, we have now come around to understand that we do have our own resident yellowfin population. It's not the migratory fish that the big eye are. We have our own. It doesn't mean to say that they don't leave here, but it's to suggest that, all right, maybe, and there's a move underfoot, I'm sure you've been told about it, and that is to increase the market size of a skipjack, of an ahi, so that it's a larger fish. So you can still consume them as a fisherman. but you can't sell them, maybe up to 10 pounds, because that's when they need to be get to breed. Mm. There's good science to set that in concrete with us. In other words, to have us, you know, say, okay, bring the hooks in. You know, these fish are a little bit too small. We haven't done that in the past.
Well, you know, there's a lot of controversy in the scientific community on that whole issue of sort of traditional fisheries management as it evolved in the North Atlantic was largely based upon the idea of leaving fish up to a certain size before you start to catch them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's still the dominant dogma. There's a new movement that's called balanced harvesting that suggests we would do better by harvesting a little bit of everything, regardless of the size.
Mm-hmm.
I really haven't made up my mind on this, and I'm just off to Australia with some of the people who are arguing for the balanced harvesting. And the idea is you take a little bit of everything, because right now we take most of the fish we catch are large fish that are high on the trophic chain.
Mm-hmm.
And compared to what the natural predators take, we take very little of the small fish, whether they're small in total size or just the small ones of the bigger species.
And, yeah, so it's a kind of a dilemma, right? I mean,
I don't think the story's told on that.
Well, speaking about that, we've run out of time in this segment. Can you come back again? Can we talk some more?
Oh, I'd be happy to come back.
Dr. Ray Hilborn will be back. That's going to do it for this week's show. We want to tell you how much we appreciate you listening. Remember, you can find out scads of new information and additional information at the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council website. That's WPCouncil.org. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you again next time for Go Fish. And remember, if there's something you want to hear, all you got to do is let me know. The Mike Buck Show at AOL.com or the Mike Buck Show at gmail.com. Have a great day in Hawaii. And we'll see you next time on Go Fish.